friends. In our papers quite recently, there has been rather a remarkable story concerning a 4-year-old Irish child. It appears that this little girl settles down every night for a 3-hour reading session. She takes an encyclopedia, a textbook, or a French storybook, and seems to understand and enjoy them all. Who is this little girl? Well, she's called Mary, and she lives in Chapeltown, Northern Ireland, where they call her the golden-haired genius. Mary, it appears, reads in French, English, and even Gaelic, a very difficult language, and she translates readily from one language to the other, according to the newspaper reports. They say that in French she can tackle textbooks designed for 12-year-old grammar school students. In Gaelic, she reads storybooks, translating everything back into English. Her reading ability, not unnaturally, has astounded her parents. Mr. Jerry Gilchrist, her father, is a farmer, and his wife Bridget is a former teacher. And they say, "It has me beaten. We haven't been able to stop her reading since she was 3 years old," said her mother. "One day," she went on, "about 6 months ago, I found her on the living room floor thumbing through a French book. She simply told me, 'Well, Mummy, I've read all the English books in the house, and so I have now to read something in French.' Isn't that a remarkable story? And as of course you must know, the appearance of child prodigies and geniuses is far from uncommon. How do the teachings of Theosophy explain such phenomena? As my title suggests, Theosophy teaches that man evolves to the stature of perfected manhood through successive lives here in physical bodies on this earth. It teaches also that we progress in every life, that what we learn is not forgotten, and that sometimes the memory may show itself. Generally, it shows itself as a natural capacity, an ease in certain directions, but sometimes also as an actual remembrance. Mary Gilchrist, who reads for 3 hours every night, was apparently remembering those languages. And the explanation is that she was, in fact, remembering how to read and those various tongues. Let us look at this idea. It's well worth examining, especially in these days of international crisis and a great deal of personal testing and difficulty as well. As you are also aware, this doctrine of reincarnation has gained and is gaining a wide acceptance nowadays. Why is this, may we suppose? Well, I think reincarnation is becoming so very acceptable in Western countries. It's always been part of thinking in the East, you know. It's acceptable amongst ourselves largely because it provides logical answers to certain problems of life which are unanswerable without it. And by answerable I mean, of course, in terms of reason. What kind of problems are thus answered? Well, justice, for example. Justice in human affairs. And another, the meaning and the purpose of human life, if any purpose there may be said to be. There are other problems which reincarnation answers, such as recorded memories of former lives, and the one I've just advanced, child prodigies. Let us, however, look at the two main problems in the time that we are to have together, and then we'll apply the doctrine of rebirth to them. Take the first problem, that of justice in human affairs, which means the existence of undeserved human suffering, especially of newborn children. We must agree, I think, that this appears to deny the existence of divine justice. Those of us who are brought up as Christians are informed and are ready to believe that the God who reigns above and within man is indeed a God of justice, and further, that his justice, whilst absolute, is yet ever tempered with mercy. God's just law is said to be administered with divine tenderness for all that he has made. The heart answers to this belief, doesn't it? Instinctively, we're ready to believe in and with reverent love to worship a God of divine justice and compassion. We're brought up to revere an all-loving Father in heaven, aren't we? Nevertheless, no one at all observant of common human experience, especially that of human suffering, can deny at least the appearance of the most cruel injustice in human affairs. Take the case of newborn children that I referred to just now. No thoughtful individual can long be blind to the inequalities of health and opportunity under which children are innocently and quite helplessly born. In this, as in so much else, one must confess to the appearance of the most cruel injustice. We know very well, don't we, that some children are born with healthy bodies, and they have happy homes where they are loved and cared for, homes in which every opportunity is provided for their happiness and their progress in life. Yet millions of other children are born, or perhaps I could say continue to be born, under conditions of the greatest difficulty. Their infant bodies are malformed, tainted with disease. We've all been horrified, haven't we, about the thalidomide babies? Some children are born blind, deaf, dumb, apparently condemned from birth to lives of the greatest limitation, if not misery. Some are born illegitimate and bear the stigma and the psychological crippling which can result throughout their lives. Others arrive into homes of vice, poverty, dirt, and disease. They're unwanted from conception. They're unloved from birth. They're hungry, poor little creatures, neglected and beaten all too often, as we see in the papers, as they grow up. And such children start life with the severest handicaps. Many of them create a modern problem: youthful delinquency. So, don't you think that observing this one phenomenon alone of the inequalities of birth, the mind can hardly avoid the question, if there be a God of justice, of love, and of compassion, why then does he permit the age-long and unchanging continuance of such cruel injustice? Why does God send millions of his children from heaven down to earth into conditions in which health, happiness, and fulfillment are virtually impossible? And if we'd time, we could follow the problem on into adult life, where we find that the wicked prosper and the saintly suffer. The English poet Dryden posed this question very neatly in his words: virtue in distress and vice in triumph make atheists of mankind. I'm afraid that is all too true. And so that's our first problem, that of apparent injustice to mankind on earth. The absence, shall I say, of fair play for man. And the second one, the ultimate goal of human life, the purpose of human existence, if purpose there be. We may brand as pessimists those who recognize the uncertainty of life, the apparent hopelessness and purposelessness of human existence, but that doesn't answer the question. It arises because, for a very large proportion of the human race, life is lived under the perpetual shadow of fear. Fear resulting from financial security, for example, from the threat or the actual onset of disease, the recurrent depressions, and the constant threat and occasional outbreak of terribly destructive wars. The so-called pessimist has some ground, much ground, I think, for the questions. What hope is there in a life which may at any moment either be rendered insupportable or be swept away? What hope is there for a humanity which is continually decimated by war, pestilence, flood, famine, and disease? What light is there to be found in a world which is so overshadowed by these dark clouds? And we have to face it, for they do exist and they do overshadow human life here on earth. And so we can ask, what value, what purpose can there be in such a life? Now, what does theosophy answer? Well, I'm going to draw upon it, which really is the inherited wisdom of the ages, known even in olden days as the ancient wisdom, and called by the Greeks Theosophia, hence our present word theosophy, divine wisdom. Theosophy says, and I advance the teachings directly, that divine justice does rule the world, and that there is a meaning and a purpose behind human life. Despite the appearance of injustice, perfect justice is in fact ensured, assured indeed, to every human being by the operation of the compensatory law, the law of cause and effect. And as for the purpose and the goal of human life, theosophy teaches that this is, as I said at the beginning, the evolution of the human soul to the stature of the perfected man. Please remember those words, may I ask you? The evolution of the human soul to the stature of the perfected man. For it is not this named bodily person with its male or female sex and characteristics. It isn't this bodily person who evolves to perfection. It is the indwelling spiritual self, which, according to the theory of reincarnation, through many bodily lives, reaches the stature of perfected manhood. And so the purpose and the goal of human life is stated to be the evolution of the human soul, remember, to the stature of the perfect man, a state of complete fulfillment and of the highest development of every possible human faculty. Yes, and one might add, the faculty of expressing such development with flawless genius at every level. This is rather wonderfully put by St. Paul in Ephesians 4:13, where he describes human destiny. Here are St. Paul's words. Till we all come in the unity of the faith and of the knowledge of the Son of God unto a perfect man, unto the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ. There, according to St. Paul, according to our Bible, and to the teachings of the ageless wisdom, there is the goal of human life, clearly described, to come unto the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ. That is why we are here. That is the great deliverance to which we are all journeying. That is why we endure our manifold afflictions, experience our upliftments, and our joys. For all of these, the manifold experiences of life, these are the means whereby the divine powers within us, asleep many of them, gradually awake from their sleep and are developed. They germinate, rather like seed powers in the beginning, and eventually, when the goal is reached, they will shine forth in full perfection. Encouraging also is another statement of the ancient wisdom, and that is that this attainment of perfection is utterly certain for all men. Isn't that a very wonderful idea? The attainment of perfection is certain for all men. Our Lord affirmed this saying according to the Revised Version, "Ye shall be perfect, even as your Father, which is in heaven, is perfect." Matthew 5:48. There are the teachings of theosophy on the subject, but even so the question still remains, by what means shall we find the power, the time, and the opportunity with which spiritually to grow out of our present weaknesses into the full manifestation of our divine strength? For it is obvious we cannot do that in one life. We cannot become perfect physically, intellectually, and spiritually, in one incarnation only. If there's only one life, then the task of reaching Christhood would seem to be hopeless of fulfillment. Man is foredoomed to failure from the beginning, and this for want of adequate time, an adequate opportunity in which to develop to the point of genius every human faculty, to master every weakness, and ultimately to shine forth with every godlike power. Yes, if there's only one life, it would not seem to be possible, but, and here's where the reincarnation idea comes in with such great force, for if reincarnation be true, if we return to earth time and time again, growing a little on each occasion, then the possibility of full attainment exists. If at the close of each life we have advanced a few steps, in some very successful lives, perhaps many steps, towards the great goal, then the possibility of achieving perfection at the end of a number of such lives immediately presents itself to us, does it not? If those are the conditions under which human life is planned and lived, then our problems are solved. There is justice for man, and there is a glorious purpose and a goal for human existence. Under these conditions, an almost infinite vista opens out before each one of us. You and I, we face a future which is full of light, full of promise, the certainty of spiritual victory. It is not difficult to understand, is it, that such a belief in spiritual evolution through successive lives on earth would inspire hope and give confidence and courage to those who are able to accept it. And this, I expect, is the reason why, from time immemorial, Millions upon millions of people have built their very lives upon these two ideas. Evolution to perfection through successive lives on earth and the assurance to man of absolute justice under the operation of a law of cause and effect. Sometimes it is admitted a man or a woman dies because before the effects of their action have had the opportunity to reach them. In such case, that the effects are held over in a kind of suspension, as it were, and then, in a later life, sometimes at birth, if that is appropriate and just, the effects, beneficial or unfavorable, begin to be precipitated upon the person in their new life. So that whatever happens to us, whatever the conditions are, they are the result of our own actions in former lives or earlier in our present lives. And thus, perfect justice is ensured to every human being. Now, may I sum this up in four basic theosophical statements? I've presented them to you, but I'm now going to leave them with you in a straightforward, simple statement. Here it is. Perfection, or Christhood, is the assured goal of every human being. Next, reincarnation, or successive lives on earth in physical bodies, reincarnation is the method of attainment. Reincarnation provides the necessary time and opportunity in which to attain. Then, the causative law of sowing and reaping, as St. Paul called it, of cause and effect, action and reaction. The causative law of cause and effect ensures perfect justice to every human being, and, as it happens, to nations as well. And lastly, and wonderfully, ultimate and complete success is assured by virtue of the presence of an infinite divine power ceaselessly at work within the soul of every human being. I find I have a little more time to be with you, and I've just been rereading that wonderful poem by John Masefield, A Creed. It's fairly well known, but I have time for a few verses. He wrote these words, A Creed by John Masefield. I hold that when a person dies, his soul returns again to earth. Arrayed in some new flesh disguise, another mother gives him birth. With sturdier limbs and brighter brain, the old soul takes the roads again. All that I rightly think or do, or make or spoil or bless or blast, is curse or blessing justly due for sloth or effort in the past. My life's a statement of the sum of vice indulged or overcome. And as I wander on the roads, I shall be helped and healed and blessed. Dear words shall cheer and be as goads to urge to heights before unguessed. My road shall be the road I made. All that I gave shall be repaid. Now the last wonderful verse. So shall I fight. So shall I tread in this long war beneath the stars. So shall a glory wreath my head. So shall I faint and show the scars. until this case, this clogging mould, be smithied all to kingly gold. Of course there are many, many stories of recorded memories of former lives. Not many, I believe, in which two different people have the same memory. Here is one, for of course that makes it very much more definite if two independent people remember the same events concerning each of them. Here's a fully authenticated story of that kind. It's told about an officer in the Indian Army in the days of the British Raj in India. This officer remembered distinctly being a high official in the court of one of the pharaohs. There he fell in love with a dancing girl in ancient Egypt, but the disparity in their social positions made marriage so far impossible. So they did what so many couples did then and have done ever since, they eloped. They fled one night into the Theban desert and had hardly got clear of the city before they were overtaken by a sandstorm. Before he could wrap her burnous or scarf round her mouth and nose, the sand enveloped them and they were both suffocated. Often and often did he have the old feeling of choking, as though repeating the supreme incident in the past. But he never met the girl in this life. One night, however, he was at a conversazione of the Royal Society when on leave in England. Knowing no one, as he thought, he looked around. There, across the room, he saw a girl, leaning against the wall, staring at him. Something impelled him to move towards her, and he did so, and she simultaneously moved towards him, and they met across the room. When she reached him, she put out both her hands and said, "Suffocated." "What," he said, "do you also remember?" "Yes, indeed I do," she said, "and how you tried to wrap my scarf round my mouth." There, you see, is a specially interesting case, as I said at the beginning, where two people remember the same thing. Perhaps before I leave the story, I ought to say, yes, they're married now.